morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I am Michelle Groman for court-appointed amicus curiae, arguing in support of jurisdiction. If the court permits, I would like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal. This court plainly has jurisdiction for three reasons. First, at the time Mr. Sathyanathan filed his petition for judicial review, there was no motion for reconsideration of the November 8th order pending before the commission. As the commission concedes, both in the proceedings below and its briefing to this court. Second, to rule for the commission, the court must necessarily hold that Mr. Sathyanathan's untimely motions for reconsideration told his time for filing a petition for judicial review. That position would go against the precedent of this court as well as the Supreme Court. Third, under the commission's argument that the November 8th order was somehow not final until the commission ruled on February 2nd, Mr. Sathyanathan would be completely barred from seeking judicial review. A petition for review prior to February 2nd would have come too early, while one coming after would be too late. That outcome simply makes no sense.
Couldn't he have filed a petition for review after the commission's February 2 denial of his third motion?
On February 2nd, yes, Your Honor, the commission denied his attempt to file it out of time for the last.
If they had granted it, it could have obviated the need for this appeal, correct?
In a very attenuated way, yes, Your Honor.
Well, why attenuated? I mean, he was asking for rehearing. It took him a while to get it right, and the commission could have accepted the overlong brief, right? The commission had the authority to do it, and if it had, maybe it would have reheard the case and ruled for him.
His motion, this fourth motion that came before the commission, was a petition for review of the December 20th order.
Right.
If the commission had granted that, that would involve re-looking at the December 20th order to decide whether or not the motion for reconsideration was timely filed. There would then be another step to decide.
Didn't the commission treat the first three? Let's see. Okay. Okay. His first filing his first filing was timely, right? But not acceptable because it couldn't be read, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Then the commission accepts the second one.
The commission conditionally accepts the second one.
But as timely.
It conditionally accepts it subject to
filing a conforming brief.
Yes, Your Honor.
So as far as the commission was concerned, his filings were timely but defective because the brief was too long. But they were timely in the commission's view.
At the end of the day, there was nothing ever timely filed because the commission first,
I assume what you're saying there is to be timely, it has to be consistent. There has to be no other defects in it.
It has to be timely and in conformance with the commission rules.
Well, where does that come from, that rule? The commission treated these as timely because otherwise, if they weren't timely, it wouldn't have given him more time to file a conforming brief.
Well, the commission said file a conforming brief by December 4th or no other extensions will be granted. You will not have a chance to file a timely brief.
Right.
It then said that after three attempts, he had never filed a timely motion for reconsideration.
Right. But then the commission treated his fourth motion, it didn't just reject it, it rejected it on the merits, right?
It did, but that was not a motion for reconsideration of the November 8th order. That was a petition for review.
But it was a potentially dispositive motion in terms of it could have obviated the need for the appeal. Isn't that the purpose of this thing? The purpose of this is, correct me, I actually find this procedural case confusing here, but the purpose of this rule, right, is to prevent people from pursuing both the administrative and the appellate remedies simultaneously.
That is correct, but the purpose of limiting that to timely motions for reconsideration is to keep someone before the agency from indefinitely tolling by making non-conforming, self-styled motions for reconsideration.
That question if we treat his first three as timely.
But they weren't.
They were procedurally defective, but the commission thought they were timely.
The commission said the first one was timely, but illegible and was therefore not accepted.
Now, you're clearly right if the rule is it has to be both timely and with no other defects. You're absolutely right about that. But this could be, the commission didn't seem to have treated it that way.
The commission did say no further filings would be accepted, that there was never a timely motion filed despite three attempts to do so. There were two defects here. Mm-hmm. It was over length, and it was never filed with the commission's conditions in the given 10 days, and the commission said it would not give any more time. Moreover, to go back to question that you had asked, which is what if he had filed...
Let's pursue Judge Tatel's thought here. You know, the federal rules, appellate procedure, as well as the district court rules, say that the clerk may not refuse to accept a filing because it is defective in form. So I thought the commission here was saying, we can't read the first notice. It's been something that's legible, but we'll treat it as a proper filing. And then when he submits in response to that, they say, no, it's not consistent with our rules, and so we'll accept it, but it's conditional upon complying. And then he fails to comply, and they say, therefore, there's nothing pending before us. That's your reading of the record?
That's close to my reading of the record, that he filed it, that it was not accepted on November 20th.
So the commission's final decision reverts back to its earlier acceptances?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Well, I'm just trying to find out when the commission's order became final. Mm-hmm.
Given that there was never a timely motion for reconsideration, I would say the commission's order was final when it was entered, November 8th.
Go
ahead.
No, you go ahead. Well, I was just going to... Look... Suppose his December 4 filing, okay? Suppose that had attached to it a brief that did meet the commission standards, page standards, right?
Yes.
Okay, the commission could not have rejected that as untimely, correct?
I'm not sure what the commission
would
have done,
because the commission had already said to him, we're giving you additional time to file a conforming brief.
Yes, and
so the commission couldn't possibly have then said, well, we're denying this because it's untimely now.
Unless something else was wrong with it, I assume.
No. That wasn't my question. So up through that filing, it was timely. By the commission's own actions. The commission had given him more time to file a conforming brief, and because had he done so, it would have had to accept it. Clearly, the only basis for rejecting it was it wasn't a conforming brief, not that it wasn't timely.
Up to that point, I would say it was potentially timely, given if it were then filed by December 4th in conformance with the length limitations. However, it wasn't. There was never a timely motion for reconsideration in conformance with the commission rules filed.
Well, but that's not what the commission is saying. If that was the rule, then the commission would not have given him additional time. If the rule was to be timely, that is to toll the period of time for appealing, you had to file a procedurally undefective brief, then the commission would have rejected, in fact, it would have rejected the very first one because it was illegible.
And
it didn't do that. So the commission thought they were, although defective, timely. And it was trying to help him file a procedurally acceptable, non-defective brief. So that's why I keep saying that it looks to me like the commission thought these were timely, and that what The fourth motion was a motion to reconsider the denial of a timely filed motion, which if the commission had granted, could have made it unnecessary to appeal. So that you, because of that, you do have this problem of a petitioner pursuing both an administrative remedy and an appeal, which is exactly what we say you can't do.
On February 2nd, the commission could have said something that, as I had mentioned before, in an attenuated way, could have changed the November 8th order. If it had, Mr. Sathyanathan probably would have filed an additional petition for review at that point to a new final order. The commission did not do that on February 2nd. On February 2nd, it confirmed again that
there's potential here. We're worried about.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's right. Correct. I mean, we're worried about go ahead. I was looking for a case. I couldn't find it. Go ahead.
I believe I actually had finished my thought there. I can see that.
I'm sorry.
No, it's perfectly fine, but I'm rather over time. Are there other questions at this point I can answer for Your Honors?
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, can I add to the jurisdiction? Can I make some answers to some of the questions you raised?
Yes.
I just wanted to point out that the commission's second order specifically ruled that no timely brief was filed. Now, the commission may have erred in that, but there's really no reason to punish me about the jurisdiction thing. I'm not a lawyer. I'm forced to represent myself because of my financial circumstances. And the fact that I would have gotten into this quagmire and all that would have been some of the foreseeable stuff that Smith Barney and Morgan Stanley may have foreseen when they forced me to represent myself by terminating me. The other thing is this, I realize that in federal courts, defective documents are accepted, but it appears that the SEC is different. Seems to have their own different procedures. And also, I'd like to point out that according to the SEC's procedure, the petition for review, which is the final document I filed, is actually different from a motion for reconsideration. Now, for example, there are different time limits. There were only 5 days to file a petition for review of the order issued by the secretary, whereas I had 10 days to file a motion for reconsideration of the November 8th order, which was issued by the commissioners themselves.
All right. You want to get to the merits since you don't have much time?
Okay. I just want to point out that this case is bigger than me. For example, in recent testimony of Congress, former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan testified that he was shocked that the markets had not self-corrected. But self-correcting by corporations involves dissent, of which whistleblowing is part of. And this case shows that the self-correction mechanism on Wall Street is not working properly. I'm a whistleblower on criminal activities by Smith Barney and Morgan Stanley, leading NASD member firms. And in my case shows the price of whistleblowing is very high. For example, I'm the first stockbroker who have been barred by the NASD solely for making unsuitable recommendations. In fact, I've been given two bars, one for each of two customers, two 20-year-olds, Mr. Venkatrami and Mr. Srinath, just for making unsuitable recommendations to them. I believe that my punishment is excessive and oppressive given the circumstances. I believe that the SEC failed to consider the interests of investors and the public interest in protecting whistleblowers, while the SEC arbitrarily denied my whistleblower defense. Also, the SEC was obliged to do so pursuant to Section 19 of the Act, according to an opinion issued last year by this court, which was Past Securities and Joseph Mizrahi versus Securities and Exchange Commission. Now, a close look at the record of this case will show that the NASD failed to meet its initial preponderance of the evidence burden of proof. For example, I've been barred for making unsuitable recommendations based on the NASD's and SEC's guesses as to what the customers, Mr. Venkatramani and Mr. Srinath's investment objectives were. Mr. Venkatramani and Srinath never cooperated with the NASD and never testified anywhere in any forum. In fact, the only witnesses at the NASD hearings were me and the NASD investigator who admitted to receiving her documents from the same Smith Barney and Morgan Stanley executives against whom I had whistleblown. Now, showing that my whistleblowing was a factor in the bar is relevant to note the NASD and the SEC consider whistleblowing as an aggravating factor justifying a bar, because what the NASD and SEC does is they label whistleblowing as refusal to take responsibility and finger-pointing. For example, the only decision in this case that actually has references to the record is the first decision, the November 30th, 2004 NASD hearing panel decision, where they wrote, the hearing panel, and I quote, finds numerous aggravating factors that justify a bar in this case. Foremost is Satyanathan's refusal to accept responsibility for his misconduct and his attempt to shift responsibility of the registered representatives to former firms and supervisors. Moreover, Satyanathan had engaged in a continuing effort to blame others for his customers' losses. Viewing his strident and unyielding claims as a whole, the hearing panel concludes that any sanction short of a bar would not affect Satyanathan's future conduct. Now, however, despite ruling that I refused to accept responsibility, the same decision, NASD hearing panel decision, early on page 15, had included the excerpt from my testimony with respect to Mr. Venkatramani, where I testified. I basically screwed up in September 2000, where I made a wrong decision, where I made a wrong recommendation, which turned out to be wrong. Now, in addition to verbally taking responsibility, I had intervened in customer Venkatramani's arbitration and ensured that Smith Barney had produce critical documents that Smith Barney had failed to produce in response to discovery requests. Now, this introduces another aspect of this case. In addition to a whistleblower, I was also a witness where these people, Smith Barney and Morgan Stanley, tried to retaliate against me in order to discredit my testimony. There was a critical, important aspect to this case. Mr. Venkatramani's unsuitable recommendations had been made without I knowing, and Mr. Venkatramani apparently not knowing, that the Smith Barney had made an error in his account. They had incorrectly valued his account value at $14 million instead of the $10.5 million actually was. Now, my testimony shows that I had been influenced by this thing. My recommendation was to diversify on margin the account value greater than $10 million. Now, this is simple. Now, for Mr. Srinath, the SEC provided only one reason why they believed my recommendation was unsuitable. That is, I had recommended the purchase of Class B mutual fund shares instead of Class A mutual fund shares. Now, the only difference between the two is what I call, the primary difference between the two is what they call 12B1 fees, which comes to a maximum of about 75 basis point, 7.5% a year, where Class B shares are generally cheaper until, according to the SEC, if you concentrate the purchases of mutual funds, so you get purchase 1 million of mutual funds in a one company, mutual fund company, the front end loads of Class A shares disappear. Now, I had produced documents, studies on the record showing that there's a cost to this. The SEC opinion, the employee who prepared the opinion for the SEC Commissioner's review, he failed to comprehend that fact. And, I dispute the fact that the SEC's assumption that the Class B shares are more expensive than Class A shares. In fact, subsequent NASD decisions to mine have ruled that cost is not the only factor in making recommendations that Recommendations would also include the various rewards. And I had recommended high-performing mutual funds from different mutual fund companies instead of concentrating it on one mutual fund company so that you also buy lower-performing ones in order to get that discount. Now,
I think we understand most of your arguments from your brief. Is there anything else that you would like to let us know?
Yeah. That is to look at the Venkatraswamy case. The Srinath thing is simple. For Venkatraswamy, there was an opinion issued last year by this court, Lesson versus Merrill Lynch and stockbroker Bernstein. This case is actually similar to that. Lesson was a Yahoo employee.
We can read the case.
Yeah. And similarly, Venkatraswamy was a Juniper employee. He had a concentrated position on which Lesson had diversified buying one stock in some BEOS company. For him, Venkatraswamy, I recommended buying mutual funds, which is much lower risk than buying stock, and warrants. Now, the purchase of Class B mutual funds were again called unsuitable, despite the fact, I believe, and they showed evidence on the record, the Class B shares are cheaper than Class A shares.
All right, but I think you said all this either earlier today or in your brief.
Okay.
Is there anything new?
Just two more new things, Your Honor.
Very quickly.
One is quickly about the warrants. They were called unsuitable despite the fact that conservative investor Warren Buffett had been buying warrants recently.
All right. What else?
The other two points are the SEC opinion. SEC had mischaracterized my arguments in several respects. And if they had actually taken my arguments, if they had fully taken my arguments properly, they would have seen that I had valid arguments to make.
All right. Thank you. Let us hear from counsel for the SEC.
On the jurisdictional question, prior to the filing of the petition for review before this court, as we know, the petitioner filed a motion to the commission to reconsider its November 8th order. The motion was filed within the 10 days that the commission rules allow for motions for reconsideration. That would cause the November 8th opinion to become non-final. And it would continue non-final until the commission on February 2nd resolved the questions with the motions for reconsideration. And at that point...
Go ahead, Judge Kavanaugh.
What about the December 20th order that says no further filings will be accepted?
Well, that was the decision that the commission took up. In other words, that's the secretary's final order. But it isn't... He filed timely. He was given time to do several things.
So the commission's theory is that all of the previous filings were timely?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Even though defective?
Right.
Okay, so now go ahead and finish your answer to Judge Kavanaugh.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but I should finish my answer? Was there an outstanding question?
I shouldn't have interrupted. I just wanted to know whether the previous motions
were... Well, it just seemed like it said on December 20th, no further filings will be accepted.
Well, that's so she didn't give him any more
time. You can keep
filing. But that's
not
saying anything you filed was untimely. The reason that the fourth motion was timely is because it was a motion to reconsider the December 20th order.
I take it by a different, entity, right? That was by the commission. Is that right?
I'm sorry?
That was to the fourth order was directed to the commission?
Well, they were all motions to the commission, but the secretary started with them. The secretary was using an operation similar to the 25A4 provision in the Court of Appeals rules that says, well, the clerk, you know, can't refuse things when their only problem is that their form is not in accordance with the rules. And all of those motions that he sent in were timely, but they weren't in accordance with the rules. They had.
Wouldn't this allow the someone to re-trigger the time to petition for review just by filing something way out of time and saying, well, the commission occasionally will make an exception for an untimely?
I think it's the sort of thing that the commission could be trusted to stop in its tracks. In other words, this person was a pro se and had some troubles with the facts. It would be natural to accept them for a while, but not for
your
a long
point
time.
That, I thought your point was is that these, even the fourth one was timely under the commission's rules.
Yes, it was straight timely.
Now, suppose it hadn't been. Suppose it had, how many days? You had five. He had 5 days. Is that what the rule is? Or 10?
No, actually, you have 10 days to file a motion for
reconsideration. Okay, suppose he had filed the fourth motion 15 days later. That would have been out of time.
I think that's exactly.
Now, would that be a different case now?
Yes. Well, yes, it would.
Does the commission have the authority to waive those time limits?
Oh, I assume so. It did. I mean, it didn't say I'm waiving time limits, but it gave him
even
it
if
just
it's out of
time.
Even if it's out of time, the commission could have could have excused it and accepted it. Correct?
I'm sure. Not sure of that, and that didn't happen here. But I'm.
I know, but you don't know the answer to that.
I think so. It should be able to waive its own time.
Okay. Well, then that brings me back to Judge Kavanaugh's question. If the commission can always waive its time limits, then my question to you, well, wasn't this within the time limit, doesn't really respond to his concern. Right? I mean, they could file it a year later, and the commission has the authority, you just said, to say, yeah, I know you should have filed it within 10 days, but we're going to accept it anyway.
Well, Your Honor, it is possible, but I just think it's extremely unlikely. It happens so often with the ordinary filings that you would get every day where something's wrong or something's missing. And the practice of accepting them and seeing if they can become in compliance doesn't suggest you'd be accepting things a year out of time.
Yeah. So at what point is the order final?
The November 8th order?
The commission's dispositive order in this case.
The February 2nd order. Yeah. Yes. It's final when it's decided. It decided everything about those motions for reconsideration, admittedly negative to South Yonathan. And
so
we believe that the 60-day period started right then to file a petition for review. But he didn't do it, and so this court lacks jurisdiction.
So if he files another motion for reconsideration today, and it's denied, would that re-trigger a new 60-day period for filing a petition for review in this court?
I hate to say no, even though that would be common sense, because I bet there are cases in the world where something very unusual has happened and they have accepted motions like that. But I don't think that the theory of this really implicates, outstanding motions.
Maybe the answer is, I suppose one answer to that question might be, well, that's up to the commission. If the commission rejects the late motion because it's untimely, that does not, I mean, the commission has control of this, right? It can control when its orders become final.
Yes, they're its own rules.
Yeah.
Doesn't the commission in the February 2nd order say that no motion to reconsider is pending before the commission because there's never been a filing in compliance with the rules of practice?
It does say that. I read that as meaning we're deciding and now there's nothing pending.
Mm.
But I have.
That's,
yeah, exactly.
That's an aggressive reading.
My boss said, oh, no way. It means. They said that. We're just trying to give the court our understanding of what is the most likely interpretation of the substance, how it occurred, and how your rules would then apply to that. And it seems to us that
under the rules, federal rules, if I file a pleading and I file it timely, but I don't conform with some form requirement, the pleading is still filed.
Right.
And then the district court or the court of appeals has to decide what to do with that pleading. And it could decide, I suppose we're rejecting it because it's not in proper form, or rejecting it more on the merits because it's not in proper form. But there's something pending that's timely, and it's just confusing here.
I know. I think so too, Your Honor.
And you're saying a pro se litigant is told that this is conditionally accepted as timely, and now basically being told that his petition for review, we lack jurisdiction. I mean, it's an odd situation.
Yes, it's a
When a reasonable person have read the February 2nd order and said, okay, well, I guess they're saying I never had a motion for reconsideration pending, therefore I don't have to refile the petition for review in court.
I think that's possible. Definitely.
Yeah, I think that's very likely.
Yeah. Although I don't think it, I'm not sure it happened here.
Why not?
I think he said that he thought he was through, but then he went on to the other request to the commission. But you can ask him when he's back. But I think it, as many aspects of this law, the area, it could have been confusing to him.
All right. Anything further?
Pardon?
Anything further?
Well, you mean on jurisdiction?
No, I think we've sort of exhausted that for the moment.
Oh, yeah. The merits. Yes. Sorry. Well, as you know, Sathyan is being sanctioned for unsuitability, for not having a reasonable belief that his customer would be, that the recommendation to his customer would be acceptable given the customer's financial circumstances and need. There's plenty of evidence, substantial evidence in this record to support that. Sathyanathan did know that Venkatramani was extremely unsophisticated in investment areas, and he knew that his account contained really only one stock, and a volatile stock at that. And he knew that Venkatramani, that his objective and goal was to preserve his wealth. So Sathyanathan actually looked at some hedging mechanisms that would have done that, but he decided to reject them and make his own recommendation, which was 3.5 million of Class A mutual funds and a bunch of other non-Class A, did I say, I said it wrong, Class B mutual funds and a bunch of other non-Class A stock and some $1 million worth of warrants collateralized on
now
margin.
He says he's being punished because he was a whistleblower.
I know he says that. The reason that he was that the NASD and the commission did not adjudicate on the area of whistleblowing is because he was in the wrong forum. He protested that because he was a whistleblower, then he would be entitled to immunity from the disciplinary process because of statutes that are criminal statutes, and they don't give any cause of action to someone who is the whistleblower.
I thought the commission's answer was going to be that under the rules, Smith-Barney was required to file these reports. The report showed that there had been a customer complaint, so an investigation was started. It had nothing to do with...
Oh, yeah. Oh, I thought you wanted to know why. No, that's true. It was definitely under the rules of routine reporting on the U-5 and the U-4 by the two former employers. And although Sathyanathan says that under 3070 they didn't have to report it, they did under 3B of the bylaws and 7E of the instructions. So it definitely was.
Yeah, I have one other question. In his brief, he says he's asking the court to relieve him of the excessive, what he styles as the excessive $4,000 transcript cost. Was any such request made to the commission?
I never saw one. I have read that request.
Is that the first time
in his
it's
brief.
Been raised?
I can't remember. I'm sorry.
Well,
I just don't. I remember it because it had sort of a prominent. But I can't remember if he asked
All right.
Earlier.
All right. Anything further?
Well, I think that it's clear that the recommendations really were unsuitable. Venkatramani went through a hellish time with his account being
decimated. Your argument is there's substantial evidence and that the sanction is not excessive. And
yes, Your Honor.
I was just focusing on his allegations so that you would have a chance to respond on the record.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor.
You're very welcome. Thank you. All right. Amicus, do you want a minute here?
Thank you, Your Honor. Three very quick points. First, the fourth motion that Mr. Sathyanathan filed before the commission, the December 29th motion, was not a motion to reconsider. It was styled as such, but the commission made clear in the February 2nd order that it was that was completely improper. It was, in fact, a petition for intra-agency review of the decision made pursuant to delegated authority, the December 20th order. There are different time limits that apply. In fact, Mr. Sathyanathan did file that out of time. There were only 5 days in which to file that motion. Second, the standard...
So that motion was late.
That motion was late, but the commission decide it on the merits in the sense that it was a petition for review of the December 20th order. Second, the standard here just can't be whether the agency could have granted relief. However far out the motions were made, that is always the case with a late filing. Really, the standard is here that an untimely motion for reconsideration, no matter how late it's made and no matter when the final word is said that it's late, does not toll the time to file a petition for review. Finally, the Secretary's February 2nd action can't determine whether the November order had become final simply because Mr. Sathyanathan then could not afford to wait to file his petition for review with this court. The November 8th order was final when he filed his petition for review, and the time for filing that would not have been extended because there simply was never a valid petition for reconsideration before the agency.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Half a minute for rebuttal.
Your Honor, the Lesson versus Merrill Lynch and Bernstein case are actually very comparable. Merrill Lynch never reported the Lesson arbitration or the Lesson customer complaint to the NASD. There was never any NASD investigation against Lesson, even though the facts of the case are very similar. Both Lesson, Michael Lesson, and Venkatramani had signed their neocon forms as investment objective of growth, aggressive risk tolerance, and investment objective of allowed speculation. For Lesson, that was found that a margin account with concentrated stock and all that was suitable. For Venkatramani, what the NASD and SEC did was they ignored the documents that governed the account. They, without Venkatramani and Srinath testifying, they came up with the notion that preservation of capital was actually Venkatramani and Srinath's secret objective. And that was based on primarily twisting my testimony that the customers, like all human beings, do not want to lose money. That was somehow twisted into they want to. The investment objective was actually preservation of capital. The other thing was, I guess that was the main point I want to make. That is, the account form documentary documents were ignored, and they came up with their own theory to justify finding unsuitability.
Thank you. We will take the case under advisement.